Hello everyone, and this is Discerning Consciousness with Mike and Ant-Man.
Hi everyone. In this episode, we're going to talk about the world of work. Obviously, it's an important issue for a lot of us. Can't really avoid work.
No, not at all, really.
It's always going to be there. So that's why we've chosen it. And also, in terms of being on a spiritual path, it can often be quite a testing arena, can't it?
Yeah, because it's quite a low-level mental place, yeah. I find.
Yeah.
And if you bring in certain spiritual ideas within the workplace, it yeah. normally gets shut down quite quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's also to point out to our listeners, Mike, that as it's such a broad area, what we're going to actually focus on is work in terms of the human element and how we experience it as individuals rather than the corporate world or business or economics. And obviously, we're going to touch upon that because you cannot do that in this process.
But... yeah, I mean, there's so much to talk about within the field of work.
Yeah.
But we're going to try and keep it down to the core elements of the human being rather than the conspiratorial business economy
sure.
world.
Yeah, that's for another day. In terms of some things that we'll be talking about related to work, we'll be mainly about the aspects of social manipulation and psychology that take place within the workplace. But then on the flip side, in a more empowered sense, we're going to talk about some of the ways in which you can navigate through the work arena and feel empowered and feel like a sovereign human being rather than feel beaten down and put upon.
I was going to say, it's a hard thing to do, but it is possible. So yeah,
absolutely. Right, Mike. So the first thing we're going to talk about in terms of different subject areas related to work is identity and work.
Well, identity is quite a big thing. It's the core of who everyone is at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But you do find identity is normally downtrodden because they always try and make you just a worker bee drone
sure.
within the workplace.
Sure. And one of the ways they do this, of course, is you have to wear a uniform. There are certain expectations of the way in which you'll behave in the workplace, which impinge upon your sovereignty to behave in the way you want to as an individual.
Yep. Which, at the end of the day, leads to a certain separation of self.
Yes,
you almost
split
become
the psyche.
Two people, you know, how you are at work and how you are at home.
Yeah, sure, yeah. I know that can cause quite a lot of difficulties, can't it?
Yeah, and not only that, you know, that separation is such a core part of everyone with the fact that you spend most of your time at work.
Yeah, and this leads into the idea that in sort of modern society, we're very much defined by our job, aren't we? When you first meet someone, it will be, well, where do you live and what do you do? As if, you know, you are your credibility as a human being is around about, you know, is related to what you actually do for a job.
Yeah, not just that, but you're also judged by what you do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so depending if you've got a blue collar or a white collar job at the end of the day,
sure.
you'll be seen as a certain standing within society.
Sure. Where did this the phrase blue and white collar originate from then?
Well, I think it goes back to like the 60s, 70s, something
right.
around that period.
Okay.
You know, that's where the more office-style jobs became
sure.
more popular.
Yeah.
And obviously, you don't want to be wearing a white shirt when
sure.
you're dealing with, you know, repairing a truck
sure.
or something.
That's where,
that.
I think that's, you're right, that's where the idea of having an office job had that sort of status, whereas now we know so many office jobs are routine. It's almost like being in a factory, a different kind of factory setting, really.
Yeah.
You know.
And the last thing about this whole identity, really, and the worst bit about it, is the slave for the wage that's made out of it.
Yeah.
When you're on that salary and you've got to keep to that job because
sure.
you can't live without it.
Yeah. And then I would say on the flip side, there are some people who actually, they live for their job, don't they? So they're quite prepared to build their whole identity around their job. And they're the kind of people that do 50, 60 hours a week.
Well, those are the people that buy into that the work part of themselves and think that's who they are.
Yeah, sure.
And they
yeah.
don't see any separation from it because they've made themselves their job life.
Yeah, and they're the kinds of people that can make colleagues feel uncomfortable because you're thinking, well, you know, I'm not prepared to put in those sort of hours.
I know what you mean, like I've got a home life to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. Next, what we're talking about is what we described as the hierarchy of control. And it's a bit, I mean, on this area, we will be talking about economics, aren't we, in this area?
Well, just touching on it slightly, really. And that's because the way businesses are structured, it's all down to this manipulation, really.
Mm.
Because it always starts off with the money masters, or what's otherwise known as the people that own the means of production.
Okay, so a bit of a Marxist phrase there, yeah.
And in the end of the day, that's, well, in the common tongue, they would be called the shareholders of the company.
Sure, yeah.
because you always find that even CEOs are kind of like running the business.
Yeah.
You know, if you go to them and say, right, you can make that change, they'll be like, well, no, because I've got my shareholders to please.
And yeah, the concept of shareholders first emerged in the 1500s when
I'm not sure the exact year, but it was the whole concept of, you know, instead of owning all the goods on a ship and say if it got lost at sea you lost everything, you kind of like went in for a 10% stake with 100 ships, and that way even if one or two went, you're still making money off it, and again, that's the whole idea of not putting all your eggs in one basket.
Sure. So sort of mitigating against your losses.
And everything's just evolved from there, really.
Sure.
Yeah, so within the company, you've got the CEOs that have to answer to the shareholders.
Yeah.
And then those CEOs will have their, like, senior management team.
Yeah.
And then you get your middle management, and then right down at the bottom, you have your, like, your basic worker bee.
Sure, yeah. And then obviously within the different management structure, you've got different styles of management as well, haven't you?
Yeah, but you always find it's kind of like monkey see, monkey do with management styles, because they're all doing what they've seen their previous managers do. You know, just because they think that's how it should be done.
I mean, this brings to mind, of course, The Office, where you've got David Brent, and his style is very much the awkward, sort of hackneyed, friendly style, where he tries to, you know, share jokes with all his staff, and it all just comes across as being really crass.
Well, again, that comes from the whole need to be liked.
Yes.
And wanting to be liked.
Sure.
But certain managers are going to totally go for the arsehole style of management, which is like, you know, do the job, I don't care about you.
They don't pander to the feelings of their workers at all. It's literally playing hardball, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And there are other managers that are just easy-go-lucky, come on, like, there's a job to do, there's no point being an arsehole about it, just get on with it.
Sure.
But I have to admit, one thing I do want to just quickly mention is that within this whole
hierarchy
structure,
there's
different levels of training that are given when it comes to like, how you control.
Oh, how you motivate.
Yeah. Not just motivate, control.
Yeah. Sure.
Because you want to motivate them, but they have to be in line. They have to be controlled.
Well, I mean, the whole premise behind motivating staff is control, isn't it, in a sense?
And that really brings us on to what we like to call the psychology of control. And this goes on to what really comes down to it is the mentalist style tricks, you know, the sort of things that Darren Brown uses, you know, not to the extent that he uses those things, but, you know, the subtle ways of controlling people. Which I've always known as NLP techniques.
Can I also just add on what we were talking about in terms of the hierarchy of control? It's interesting to consider the fact that this structure is seen to be almost organic. It's like you can't, well, it's a sense in which you can't question it. It's said to be, this is how it is. You can't question it. And I'm thinking, I'm putting in mind of the film Network, and when the main character, he actually is pulled up by one of the senior management, actually probably would have been like the equivalent of a CEO, for the things that he's saying on air, which are challenging existing, you know, memes and ways of being. And he says, you know, you can't, you're meddling with the forces of nature. In other words, you know, he is in a workplace, which in this context happens to be a newsroom, and the things that he's saying are going outside of the norms.
Accepted, yeah, parameters.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's so true. And if you start questioning things, you always get kicked out.
Yeah, absolutely.
But going back onto the psychology of control, there's so many different things that are used. I mean, I have to admit, from my own workplace experiences, I've been taught certain techniques to use against the customer. I know for a fact that the higher up in management level you go, the more techniques you're taught. Because at the end of the day, you don't want your lowest level worker having the same techniques, skills that the management team have.
Yeah, sure. I mean, other aspects of the psychology of control at the workplace are, it's just an extension of the school mentality, isn't it, really?
Oh, definitely. I mean, like, at the end of the day, when you're at school, you're all sitting at your desk, you've always got the teacher at the front, and they're telling you what to do.
You have to ask when you need to go to the toilet, and it's, you know.
Yeah, and so when you, that extension into the workplace is the teacher becomes the boss and you become the student again.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously this kind of rigid setup means it's very easy for staff to get into situations where they feel like they're being bullied, like at school.
Exactly. I mean, that's why bullying is never really fully outlawed in school. I mean, they say they don't like it and they try and ban it as much as possible.
Yeah.
But it's always there. It's always been in our society.
Because of the way it's structured.
Within the workplace. So seeing it in school is just the extension of that.
Another thing that's quite interesting, I feel, from my own experience of being work, is the ways in which not just a manager will guilt trip you into certain behaviours, but also other staff who may be more accepting of, say, taking on overtime or working, you know, working beyond their hours, and then you're almost made to feel guilty.
Yeah, yeah, going above and beyond is almost considered standard practice.
That's actually, it's not in the contract, but it's implied.
Yeah, and that's again going on to the certain techniques and tricks they'll use, you know, going on to like just the morning brief, getting everyone together, singing off the same song sheet. Really ties in that whole kind of like you're part of the team.
Sure. I mean, it's very important for sort of management and companies to get this sense that you're in a team, because then it's obviously they'll think you'll work harder. But again, I think it's easier to guilt trip people in that kind of environment.
Definitely.
But also other things that a lot of our listeners and ourselves are well aware of are things like targets and key performance indicators, which are becoming more and more common, say, in the education sector, in the public sector, in jobs where it's hard to actually measure outcomes.
I was going to say, in some jobs, they make sense.
Yeah.
I mean, working in sales, having key performance indicators does make a lot of sense. But still, it's a kind of like not a very nice way of looking at the whole business role, because it's like, we need to make this much money, instead of going, well, this is how much money we made. But it gets almost devious when you find out that police officers have KPIs to hit, and it's hang on, you're expecting there to be that much crime?
And then that leads to, of course, this practice of where police officers will hit certain areas where they know people are commonly speed, and they'll be there with their speed guns.
Instead of going, it's not like firefighters are going around setting fires, so you know, like, we put out 12 fires this week, you know, we hit our target. And you find police officers doing that sort of thing. It's like, hang on.
But in certain areas, you can say key performance indicators and targets will work, but again, it comes down to how they're formulated.
But the problem about them is it brings up the great divide of us v them.
Yeah.
And again, like in a work type environment, if you make a sale but they haven't gotten for everything to fulfill your KPIs, suddenly you got to go away from, oh, that customer wasn't that nice, you know, he didn't take the insurance, god damn it. Instead of going, oh, brilliant customer, you know, he didn't take that, but he didn't need it.
I mean, also this sort of us versus them mentality can play out in terms of colleague against colleague, because you'll have one colleague that's hitting their key performance indicators and is actually really invested in it, believes in it, and then another colleague who just hates it. I remember working in retail in the past, you get those that, things like, you know, selling credit cards at the till checkout point, you get those that, oh no, I'm going to really do this, and then likes of myself, like, sod this, you know. But then it creates, again, division within the workforce.
Definitely. And these are, again, part of the techniques they use to try and get everyone on board with their manipulation techniques.
So and another point I might was interesting in terms of us and them is this feeling of staff versus management. I mean, obviously that runs through, doesn't it,
a lot. There's that constant divide, looking up, seeing ourselves, and management looking down and being unhappy with the results.
Something else that's interesting to consider in terms of psychology in the workplace is this idea of working harder versus working smarter, because they've done various studies now, haven't they, say in office places, whereby if the working week is reduced to 4 days instead of five, there's actually the office or the workplace is actually more productive.
Well, there's a big kind of like divide when it comes to that whole idea of working hard versus working smart, because every boss will go with the idea of you've got to work hard, you've got to work hard to get the results. Without thinking, well, actually, if you just work smarter, you can put less effort in and get the results you need. But then again, that comes into the manipulation technique of the more hard work you put into something, the more you are invested in that thing. Instead of if you just, you know, do a little bit of work in a very intelligent way, you get the results out, but suddenly you're not invested in it anymore. So there is that manipulation going on with that. I mean, you take the work week
Yeah.
I mean, like, the very idea that we have a five-day work week actually comes on from the whole evolution of the workplace.
Yeah, I believe in the United States, it first the seed was sort of first sown by Ford in his factories when he shut them at weekends in order, obviously, for the workers to go out and consume. That was in 1926.
He didn't even do it for the workers' rights. He just did it because I was like, well, hang on, if you're working all the time, you can't go out and buy stuff.
Sure. It was also actually clothing unions in America who were at the forefront of the campaign for a five-day week. And it was actually in 1940 in America, the Fair Labor Standards Act, I should say, was mandated. And that it brought in the introduction of the 40-hour week. So it's not that long since that's been mandated, really.
Yeah, but I have to admit, even that seems outdated in today's age.
Yeah, sure.
What was it, in the futurists?
Yeah, because, of course, in the 1950s and 1960s, there were a lot of writers that came under the umbrella of futurists, and they were predicting within 20 or 30 years that because of the increased efficiency of industrial production, the workforce would be working a lot less and we'd have all this leisure time. And the actual key consideration for political leaders and social reformers, you'd have this population with all their time on their hands. And actually, as we know, that didn't come to pass because that's not real the considerations of industry.
No, because then again, there was a big change when it all became about making the money rather than thinking about the person.
Yeah, sure. But also in the 1950s and 60s in the UK, we had this whole idea of a future based on technology. The phrase, famous phrase coined by Prime Minister at the time, and I think it was 1964 he made the quote, was about the white heat of technology, how, you know, policymakers saw this development of technology as being, you know, a really modern, dynamic thing and that it would completely change the workforce. But as you said, Mike, at the same time, from the 1970s onwards, with the development of capitalism, they kind of co-opted that agenda for their own ends, if you like.
Again, yeah. So technology definitely came into the workforce.
Yeah.
But in a way that kind of made their costs cheaper.
Yeah, sure.
So at the end of the day, it's led to the fact that people are losing their jobs to machines.
Yeah.
Because it's actually cheaper for the companies.
Yeah.
To actually build a machine to do the job than pay a worker to do the job.
Sure. And of course, another thing that's come along that's helped is the for corporations is the idea of outsourcing, isn't it?
Yeah, so outsourcing following the cheapest way to make a product, especially led to the whole China revolution with paying people minimal money to make the same product that would, you know, you'd have to pay someone double the price for to make in America or UK.
And of course, what we've seen with the development of new factories during the last 30 years in the East, in China and India, Cambodia and all these sorts of countries, essentially is it's an extension of the slavery system, isn't it?
Well, the slavery system never ended. It just got outsourced. Because at the end of the day, when you owned a slave, you had to pay for their, you know, pay for their food, pay for their clothes, pay for their housing.
Yeah.
And so all companies, well, all people and companies did back then was outsourced your care to yourself. Right. So instead of, you know, keeping a slave, they were like, no, we'll pay you money now. You've just got to look after yourself.
So what you're saying is essentially, in a kind of existential sense, we're still slaves. We just have to pay for our own upkeep.
Exactly. We never stopped being slaves. Slavery never stopped. Yeah. It just got redefined.
Yeah, they just reinvented it, didn't they, really?
But one thing I have to say is this whole, you know, like you said, the introduction of true hardcore capitalism in the 70s changed the way the world worked.
Yeah.
Because it used to be that companies existed to fulfill the needs of society.
Yes.
But now society exists to fulfill the needs of the corporation.
And we can see that in the way in which it's now clearly evidenced that corporations, with their involvement in terms of lobbying in Parliament and in the States, basically create the policies, don't they?
Yeah, and not just that. They can change the very way you think about things by the amount of money they put towards adverts on TV.
Yeah.
You know, they're changing the very way you have your mindset of society.
And, of course, they're changing people's perception of consumption and things like that. I think also it's interesting to note that the rise of the corporations from the sort of 60s into the 70s onwards came about with the changing of the political ideology, where we went, certainly in the British system, we went from a sort of more, it used to be about a, more of a fraternal system whereby the rich had a sense in which they had a responsibility for the poor.
Yeah.
And then when neoliberalism, Reaganism, Thatcherite economics came along, it was all about the fact that the corporations and the business sector create the wealth, and that idea of a responsibility, a philanthropic attitude, that's the word I found it.
Yeah.
That kind of attitude, that just was seen as outdated, outmoded, was seen as being inefficient, and that all essentially changed, didn't it?
Well, again, because of capitalism, they wanted to make more and more money,
yeah.
Which at the end of the day is just drawing more and more money out of the poor populace.
Yeah, because just briefly, if we touch upon this idea of slavery in the workforce, I'm just minded of back in the day, you had big philanthropic employers in the UK, say like the Cadbury's Empire,
yeah,
whereby they would actually house the workers, would be housed, wouldn't they? You know, in quite nice areas, you know, and they'd have a whole sort of social thing set up around work. I mean, we can say again, it's not like these people were free, but although they were in a work environment, they had a lot of things that came with the job.
Yeah, you got lots of benefits.
Yeah.
And these days, benefits are being cut and sliced and halved,
sure,
and all
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I found from my working experience, especially in the retail environment,
yeah.
is actually the workforce are cared for less than the actual customers are.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's as ironic. A worker of the company, you become a second-class citizen.
Sure, yeah. It's a good point, Mike, you make about all these little benefits that go in. Say, from my parents' generation, who are in their 70s, when they went to, you know, first started work in the 50s and 60s, you know, you would have had like a cafeteria on site, would have made really nice food. You didn't have any of the machines. And in a way, you had a lot of other benefits as well that are slowly but surely are being whittled away as well
yeah.
now, sort of thing.
But that's just the horrendous nature of capitalism for
yeah,
you at the end of the day.
Sure.
But one thing I do want to bring it back to the whole personal aspect, because obviously that was just a brief history of
sure.
how things have evolved,
yeah.
is actually talk about, you know, the workplace politics, oh, colleague vs colleague.
The dreaded politics, which obviously, you know, we see pillared in quite a lot of comedies.
Yeah, and that's, again, because you spend most of your time at work, your work colleagues almost become your second family.
They're almost, yeah, your surrogate family, in the sense of, if you think in terms of waking hours, if you're even on a 40-hour week, standard week, 38, 40 hours, you spend more of your waking hours with your work colleagues than your own friends and family.
Yeah, which is, again, one of the nasty ways in which you become indoctrinated into the
sure.
to the mindset of everyone
and also
else there.
I would add, Mike, in terms of when we were talking about identity and work and the split in the psyche, again, that affects your psyche in that you're forced together with people you wouldn't choose to associate with, and you've got to somehow get on with them, you've got to somehow, you know, create an atmosphere of harmony when they might just be arseholes.
And again, that's the whole thing of, like, smiling through false teeth and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I find that's almost the hardest part of it, when
yeah.
you have to try and get on with people that you don't like.
Yeah, sure. And in a sense, I've noticed in the workplace, in terms of politics in the workplace, that sort of pack mentality, part of our animal nature, to want to feel part of the tribe in
yeah.
the work. So that, again, it impinges on you, this idea, well, I better not say controversial things. I better not say things that even within wider society are seen as controversial. So, you know, the likes of us in the past, we might have wanted to talk about a conspiracy theory or something.
Yeah.
You know, within the workplace, big no-no.
Not even that, just the spiritual aspect
yeah,
of things.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
you get looked at weirdly, like, oh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You're one of them.
Yeah. So this leads to a very mediocre atmosphere, doesn't it, within the workplace.
I have to admit, the worst thing I find about that atmosphere is the whole kind of, like, everyone wants to gossip about everyone else.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
And especially if you're trying to follow this kind of, like, path to enlightenment, the more spiritual higher self of, it's hard to try and get into that mentality because
sure.
you just don't want to deal with that negativity.
No, sure, it's quite a difficult thing. Also, I find it interesting that there's quite a lot of unwritten rules.
Yes.
That can, I've been quite a cynical person. I've tripped myself up so many times at work because there's, you know, I've either said something that's I wasn't aware of, I shouldn't have said, or I've acted in a way that was inappropriate, you know what I mean?
And especially if you bring new ideas that, you know, companies will always have their set ways of doing things. And if
yeah,
you suddenly
sure.
bring in new ideas to that,
yeah.
it can be rejected quite harshly.
Yeah. Another thing I think in terms of politics in the workplace is sexual politics, of course. Because if you think, since the rise of feminism in the 60s, from a male perspective, it's affected how we relate to females in the workplace. Because if you think outside, if you're a single guy and you see a woman that's quite attractive, you might, you know, might be a bit flirtatious, chat a bit. You do that in the workplace since feminism was, you know, came on board. Sex pest, you know, all these connotations that it's difficult to judge how to be to behave.
I was going
to
say, the worst bit about that is it all depends, you know, especially from the female perspective, of if she likes you or not. If she likes you, she'll put up with it and go along with it. But if she doesn't like you, I think I'm going to put a sexual harassment lawsuit in.
Yeah, whereas whereas that isn't the actual context. She's just using that.
And again, I think that becomes from the whole idea of women are too afraid to actually say, no, I don't fancy that. You know, instead of actually putting the barriers in, they'll go for the sexual harassment case to put the barriers
in. Which actually, in a way, it would be easier if they were just honest and said, look, mate, I'm not interested, and walk away. And actually be easier for the guys. Oh, I know where I stand now. But it all the waters all get muddied, don't they, really?
And again, that's when the PC style environment is just destroyed.
Yeah.
Sure. Normal communication at the end of the day.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, everything's got to be to the letter, to the line.
Sure.
Got to be politically correct. Otherwise, no. You know, it may be that, you know, it's not sexual harassment. It could be that you've got to go to a racial sensitivity seminar.
Or a diversity course. Yeah. Diversity training. Sorry, diversity mind control, I should call it.
So, you know, it is a minefield. And we get that. But, you know, you just have to try your best to not get involved with it. Because at the end of the day, whatever kind of manipulation they try and chuck at you, it's how much you buy into it that lets it control you.
Yeah, and this leads on to the next area I want to talk about, which is moving away from the negativity. We've been talking about a lot about the negative aspects. Is to consider how you can be a conscious, empowered person, human being, even in the workplace, isn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, like you said, we've covered all the negative things, because it's helpful to point them out, because, you know, you want to say, oh, there's a pitfall there, there's a trap there.
Sure.
But we always like to end on the more positive notes.
Sure, yeah.
And this is to be empowered. Yeah. And that's what we're all after at the end of the day, because a lot of workplace situations, environments and setup is to take power away from you.
Sure. And also, of course, once you can see the processes, you can see a lot of the psychological techniques, you can rise above it. You're not identified with it.
Yes.
And it's about, I mean, in the past, what I've done is I've seen it, but I've reacted and got angry. And then you just become a target. They're on the radar.
It's all about rising above the manipulations. Mm. And, like, especially in the whole thing of office politics. Say there's someone you don't get on with, you don't like very much. Doesn't matter. Let it go.
Because
I actually find one of the most annoying things you can do to that person you don't like is actually treat them like another human being.
Yeah, sure.
Get to know them.
Sure.
And as soon as you actually drop that whole angerness towards them, they get pissed off so much more.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it sounds like you've used that quite a lot, Mike. And the other thing that's interesting in terms of being empowered, I know Mike and I have spoken about this, when you feel that you're on, you know, your spiritual journey towards a path of greater consciousness, you feel like you have a destiny or a mission, not in a religious zeal sense, but that you have certain skills and talents you want to bring whilst you're, you know, walking this planet. It can be difficult to be in low level jobs. You feel like you're being, you know, put upon. It's hard
to being pushed down, kept down.
Being pushed down. And, you know, I know in the past when I've been younger, you can react in a kind of emotionally immature way, which is like, oh, you know, shit, I'm being oppressed by the system, man. You know, and you want to react to that.
Chuck the job in, say,
yeah,
sod this, I'm out.
Yeah.
Drop the mic and start walking out your job. It's not the most...
We've all done it.
Yeah, it's not the most mature thing to do.
No.
I mean, I get the whole sense that why people want to do that.
Yeah, sure. Because when you are doing a really menial job and you feel like you're an intelligent person and you have this sense of destiny or mission to get stuff out there, right, your unique skills and talents, it's really difficult to see the broader perspective, isn't it?
I was going to say, one of the hardest things to understand for people on this journey that suffer this problem is that is your challenge. That is where you're meant to be.
Oh, right. So you might be, stacking shelves at midnight in Tesco's right through the night. But that's, you know, that's part of your journey at that point.
I was going to say, that's part of your training.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, yeah, you feel like you've got to be somewhere, but we in the Western world are so concerned with being there right now.
Yeah, so.
And not going through the steps to get there.
To have an awareness of the process.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, you know, doing that horrible job you don't like, you're actually going to learn valuable lessons.
Sure.
Not just about yourself, but about how to do the eventual job you're going to be doing. Sure.
So it's about having a strategy for escape as well.
And also, the biggest problem, like we were saying at the beginning with, is most people identify with their jobs.
Yeah, sure.
Because in society, we're just taught to identify with our jobs. So we get put down and start to think of ourselves poorly because we're in that
job.
That's
a very good point you're making, because even though you might want to take on board some of the ideas we're discussing about being empowered, even in a lower level job, when you go out to your mates or you meet people, they go, what? You're still working in Tesco's? You know, it's difficult.
And then you feel bad about yourself.
You feel bad, yeah.
But that's, again, part of the greater social manipulation that's going on, which, again, if you're on this path, you do have to learn to drop.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least have an understanding. Or this lends credence, Mike, then, to the Buddhist idea of, you know, we need to decide not identify with our external circumstances and not allow that to affect our kind of emotions and our mental state.
I was going to say, so the Buddhist idea of actually being happy wherever you are, no matter where you are and what you're doing.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, happiness comes from inside.
Yeah.
And not from the external.
I know myself, I know these ideas, quite a few of them, like you, inside out. But when you're actually in the cold room or, when you're in the crucible of a situation that really grates on you, it's quite difficult. But then, like you said, that's part of the training, isn't it?
Yes. And again, it's the whole idea that we've got to go through the fire to get where we want to go.
Sure.
We're not going to get there by kind of like being comforted all the way.
Yeah, sure.
Oh, there. Don't worry. It'll be better next time, you know. Sod that. You've got to go through the fire. You've got to become the warrior.
So the discomfort is what
part of the journey.
It's the learning process. Up next then, in a more positive sense, thinking of work, is alternatives. Because I know people who are becoming more conscious on the path, the 9-to-5 Monday to Friday model, you know, they just cannot tolerate. So more and more people are looking to identify their unique skills and talents and work for themselves, aren't they?
Yeah, so I see more and more people now in the spiritual movement, at least, going for the self-employed model.
Yeah.
So they're trying to get themselves up in the spiritual fairs, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
Either selling special ointments or cures, as they like to call them.
Or treatments, healings,
So using their skill sets and being empowered in their own way, which I think is fantastic for people to do that.
Yeah.
But I will say, for seeing people do that in my own environment, in my own close circles of friends, it's not easy thing to do, is it?
No, because we're still based on a very different model, which is rigid and not fluid.
Yeah.
And is really about, ultimately, the bottom line being that you have a job of some description and that you are earning enough salary, you know, to properly resource yourself. And it's like we're in that transition process, aren't we? Where I feel that we see that in the arena of relationships, where more and more people are not prepared to tolerate situations and lifestyles that grate against their unique being. You know, if you go back to the Victorian era and even in the post-war era, people were much more prepared, because of lack of education, to just stay in situations that didn't work for them, that grated against their being.
It wasn't that they were prepared to, it's that they were told to.
Yes, this is life, life is a burden, you know.
Put up with it.
And put up with it.
You know, it's the whole concept of, like, you know, you were told by your parents, like, me and your father, we put up with it, now you have to. Yeah. So that's life.
Yeah, it's like, we've struggled at the workplace, now you must. But that, I do believe, as you were saying, like certain groups of people in the alternative sphere who are using their skills and talents, you know, as you say, healing, Reiki, crystal therapy, all these sorts of things, is a transition away from that, because a lot of these people feel that they have the destiny to do these things. And also on a more economic level, it encourages a kind of localism. If you think it's about looking to the people in your local community.
Yeah.
You know, and on some level it might be, because we know people that do this, where they you swap or exchange your own skills, don't you?
I think that's a fantastic way to do it, because at the end of the day, money almost seems to have a dirty air about
it. Yeah, but it's just energy, as we know.
Yeah, and so actually swapping skills is getting things done in a much better way without having that that tinge to it.
Yeah, and also you have that, you don't have that sort of embarrassment about how much to charge. It can lead to a more fluid sort of relationship in terms of a commercial relationship.
Yeah, I have to admit, sometimes within the spiritual community, I do find the prices that some people want to charge for their services is almost astronomical.
Yeah, I think that will change over time. As I say, we're still in this transition period, and as the decades go on, we'll have a better idea of what that service is actually worth, because we're still coming from the old model, aren't we?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So, which is, again, all about kind of like hoarding wealth.
Yeah.
So you feel like, oh, I've got to charge lots because not many people are going for it, so yeah, I can actually still support myself on this.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In this model of, exchange of skills and things like that, it's kind of taking more of a formal form in terms of things called transition towns and conscious communities, where groups of people are actually getting together, all with the same kind of philosophy about what we've been talking in this section, and working together and trying to actually create, you know, a better, more conscious community. I haven't checked any of them out myself, but I know that I will be at some stage.
I mean, I have to admit, one of the major benefits of these, what you would call conscious communities, is the whole idea of that, actually, if you're helping someone because you really want to just help people, say, doing PC repairs or actually telling them how to do things, suddenly it's coming from the heart rather than, I'm just doing this for the money.
Mm.
And I have to admit, half the problem we have in our world is we have to deal with people that are doing their job just for the money. They don't like it, and so they almost exclude that horribleness onto you about, well, I don't like this job, so I'm putting up with it. Now you're going to have to put up with my bad mood.
So what they're actually doing is projecting their resentment onto you.
Yeah. And that's why we always find that, you know, you're phoning up people to try and get help, and actually they're hindering you.
Yeah, sure.
So suddenly now, if more and more people are actually doing a job that they want to do, because that's their passion in life, suddenly everything becomes better.
That's a brilliant point you make, Mike, because it's actually, that's how this world will change.
Yeah.
If you think about it.
I mean, like, I've heard in so many different areas of research that at the end of the day, it's your passion. It's what you're here to do on Earth.
Sure, yeah.
What builds you up, not what breaks you down.
Yeah.
And suddenly, if everyone was living their passion, the world would be a greater place.
If you think, if everyone is living their passion, how many people would resort to more negative patterns of behaviour? I feel like negative, aggressive patterns of behaviour come from people who, like you said, feel they're doing things where they're not being true to themselves. They're not being a sovereign, you know, authentic human being.
And it all comes to the idea of fulfillment. You don't feel fulfilled because you're not living your passion. And I mean, really, it comes down to this phrase. I can't remember who said it, but it says here, live your passion.
Yeah.
Because that way you'll never have to work a day in your life.
Because if you're living your passion, you're living your vocation. And some people, you have to say, actually are in jobs that they would do even if they weren't getting paid. And, you know, I've met a few of these people, and I have to say they are quite a joy to be around, because they are, as you say, living their passion, living their vision, living their destiny.
And they feel they're being fulfilled.
Yeah. And the other thing is, they actually feel empowered. I mean, how many people can say they're in a job, a salary job, where they feel empowered? You can never feel empowered when you're doing something that, you know, you wouldn't otherwise want to do unless you had to sell your labour to get system credits.
Yeah, I mean, like, how many people are out there who are stuck in their job because they're too afraid to leave?
Yeah, and again, that's a part of the whole social conditioning whereby people feel that they can't leave a job, they've got too much to lose, you know, they've got to stay in the system. To leave the system is the stuff of madness. And we've seen this in culture. If you think in terms of, like, the Truman Show, think of, you know, the main character, Truman. He was, you know, middle-class lifestyle, nice wife, nice office job. But and he was actually conditioned into believing this was a really good thing. He had no choice to believe, you know, to leave it. And he was living the ideal life. The truth was, it was a horror show for him.
You know. Because that becomes the entrapment.
Yeah, and we saw the social conditioning at place whereby, you know, his friend was trying to suggest he had a great life. Why do you want to leave, Truman? Your life's amazing. I just refill, you know, vending machines. You know, to him, it's like, well, wow, you work in an office, Truman. I'm jealous of you.
Air conditioning, wow.
Yeah, yeah. And this idea of work being a place of enslavement We also see in the film The Matrix, where the main character, with that beginning scene, isn't it, where he's in the office place and it's this dull, grey, oppressive environment.
You know, if you're not at your job 9 o'clock every morning, you can find yourself another one.
Yeah, and also last cultural reference. I like my cultural references.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, is the film Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Oh, such a weird film.
Yeah, where the main character, again, the main plot is he's in this grey sort of civil service environment, and yet it's about his idea, like his manager keeps wanting to promote him, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He wants to say, eventually gets the promotion, and it's even greyer and drabber. Because I remember there's one scene where he's in the office, and they've got an office next to an office, and the desk is actually going through the office space.
Yeah.
And they're both fighting over the...
And again, that's kind of reductionism at its best, you know. How can you use the little amount to get the maximum amount out of it? Because they're always using those tiny little screens with the... with the filter in between
like
to make it bigger.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. So in a sense, we can see the culture is always a reflection, obviously, of the archetypes that are existing in culture. So, again, this is why we've, you know, touched upon work this week, because it's a very important subject, and it comes right down to our identity, and especially for us as men, the idea of, you know, work defining you.
Oh, yeah, being the breadwinner. It's kind of like inbuilt into society.
It is, yeah, definitely.
But I just want to leave everyone with this point, just to get you guys thinking, is that if you don't build your dream, someone else will hire you to build theirs.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Mike, because like in our previous episodes, we like to leave our listeners on a point of positivity. And again, it's about becoming more conscious to your own empowerment and how you can shape your reality, create a life that actually, you know, reflects your true wishes, if you like.
Yeah. So we're going to be leaving you guys now. Next podcast, we will be talking about utopia ideas.
Right, excellent. Right, bye everyone.
Bye.